think this is an extremely important topic, because I don't think there's much ministry that gets more pastoral than this. It hits at the crux of Christian faith in the resurrection, and it is a singular opportunity to walk with people on their journey spiritually. I have a quote here. This is from Murray Bowen in 1976. The majority of people die alone, locked into their own thoughts, which they cannot communicate to others. That is from the article that was mentioned earlier. And it's very, very worth it for you. The majority of people die alone, locked into their own thoughts, which they cannot communicate to others. I used to really think that things had gotten better since 1976. But I attend enough funerals. I see enough people visiting with family members who are dying to think, not so. It's just not so. It hasn't gotten that much better. And absolutely current statistic tells us that 36% of people who go into hospice care go into it within 7 days of death. So, and some of them never make it to hospice care. It suggests that there's a lot of loneliness around dying. And that isn't who Christian congregations claim to be. These are just a couple of scriptures up here. But that's not the ideal that we put forward. This is from Murray Bowen, and most of the quotes I will have here are from that article. An open relationship system is one in which an individual is free to communicate a high percentage of inner thoughts, feelings, and fantasies to another who can reciprocate. That sounds a lot closer to the ideal of Christian relationship than we often see in Christian relationships, however much we claim our small groups are intimate and so forth. And he says this: few human events provide as much emotional impact as serious illness and death in resolving unresolved emotional attachments. What that says is a time around death is full of possibility, full of possibility for bridging cutoff, for a family to become more able to go forward. Well, why don't we offer? No, I'm not seeing a slide. I thought I would see. Death is a crisis in the classical sense of what we call a crisis, a time when the future is in jeopardy. A person who is dying may think about the family and say, what is their future going to be like without me? And before or after a death, the family says, what's my future going to be like without? They may not say it out loud, but that's part of what is there. Andy Lester, who was a marvelous writer on hope in a Christian life, talked about future stories. That is, we have stories in our future that we sometimes just don't even know are there. My father will be here for my seminary graduation. My uncle will baptize my child. We have those expectations, and sometimes death thwarts those expectations. Now, death is a crisis for the individual. It's a crisis for the family. Potentially, it's a crisis for the congregation, except that's not what I'm going to talk about now. I'm going to talk about that later in the day. But for the individual and for the family, for various individuals related to the person who's dying. And it is a transition for the family as a unit. Dr. McNai addressed that. It's a transition for the whole family as a unit. Bowen identifies three closed systems around dying. Now, we've said an open system is one where there's a lot of freedom back and forth. Closed systems are where there's not much connection. And he mentions the intrapsyche that most of us are scared of dying, and so we have thought processes that help us avoid that. But he also is very clear that people who are dying welcome talking about it in his experience. The family is often a closed system. Now, it is not to say that dying people aren't ever interested in baseball or football or whatever. But sometimes we visit families in hospitals and they're talking about the football team, you know, and how it's doing and all of that. And one can get a sense that the conversation never gets any deeper than that. And unfortunately, sometimes the pastor will go back to the church and somebody will say, "How's the family doing?" Not that they're going to go see them, but "How's the family doing?" And the pastor will say something like, "They're doing great. They're just talking about the Astros." Really? Maybe not doing so great. And often, the family is all there together, and so there's not too much opportunity for one-to-one conversation. People will use words, and sometimes pastors like the person's situation instead of the fact that they're dying. Murray Bowen did not give high marks to clergy and how these things. Okay, family, medical system, and okay, here's my point. I have a fourth system that often is closed, the pastor and the church. And if the pastor cannot use words like dying, the congregation is going to have a harder time doing that very thing. Bowen didn't give high marks to clergy. This is what he said. Now, this was in 1976. I don't think it's morphed just an awful lot. Clergy operate with their theology, a theory about death that does not go beyond familiar concepts of grief and mourning. And they tend to aim their help at the overt expression of grief. They may provide superficial help to the majority of people, but it misses the deeper process. Dr. McKnight's presentation spoke of this deeper process of how a family reconfigures and goes on, and how new leadership emerges. And we often miss that. We often miss being part or doing our part within that process. Now, I'm going to just say, this is what I think as a pastor. We use the term for full-grown Christians as growing into the full stature of Christ. And I think it's hard, if not impossible, for people to grow into the full status of Christ, stature of Christ, if they don't grow up in their own families. And that's what I think. And so I think it's imminently to help people grow up within their families, to consider how they behave and how they are responsible in their own families. Bowen says this about people who are helpful to people in this process. Knowledge of the total family configuration the functioning position of the dying person in the family, and the overall level of life adaptation are important for anyone who attempts to help the family before, during, or after a death. And what I want to say here is, I'm not sure who has more opportunity to do that, to have this knowledge, than clergy do. We see the entire nuclear family. Sometimes we see the entire extended family, or a large portion of the extended family. The person that an individual talks to in an office is somewhat limited by how the individual describes Uncle Joe. We may know Uncle Joe. We are often present when someone is told they are dying, or shortly thereafter, as a family makes decisions to go to, for the person to go into hospice and so forth. People talk to us when we call on them, and then we have something that no other profession has, or at least I don't know another one that does, and that's called pastoral initiative. We can call someone up on the phone and say, how are you doing with X? We can take them aside. We can invite them to our office. We can, in some circumstances, show up on their doorstep. And the last time I did that involved somebody whose daughter was imminently dying, and she didn't return my calls, and I showed up on her doorstep. Now, we have a very, what you would call, a relationship in terms of pastoral care. But we have that initiative. We also have, you know, when a family is operating in a clump, everybody is all in the hospital room and nobody is saying much to each other. It is very close. I can get in to the ICU at 2 a.m. when it's not visiting hours. I can get in at 5 a.m. I can talk to the person one-on-one almost no matter what the family conspires to do. And I can, if I will, say, you want to have some coffee with me? To an individual member of the family. If they're hurting up, I can do a little bit of cutting off from the herd. Now, we have this wonderful possibility as pastors. Why don't we? Bowen says this, no event can stir more emotionally directed thinking in the individual and more emotional reactiveness in those about him than death. We are not immune to that same fear that everyone else has. We proclaim, out of Christian tradition, we proclaim resurrection. Most of us are not willing to take it for a test drive. You know, right this minute. One of the most important things I believe that pastors can do in terms of their own pastoral care is to know their own families, to know what their families did with death. How did their families approach it? Was it a closed system? Because if it was a closed system, that's likely the pastor's norm, what the pastor feels comfortable in. And it takes some work, I believe, to get past that. But in any case, how did your family do that? How did they deal with illness? How did they deal with elderly people? How did they do with whose functioning was becoming impaired? It's really important to visit that for yourself. And I will note one other book here. This is Healing the Dying. It is by two Catholic priests to be very gifted at being dying people. She was a nun, and there were people in the house who would wait to die until she got back from trips. Because she sat with them and was extremely comfortable doing it. And this talks about the things that dying people do, and it also has four of these things, and it's framed in the seven last words of Jesus. But it has a section at the back to work through what you think about your own death, what you expect, who you want with you, what is paradise for you on earth, and who would you like to share that? All right. In terms of pastoral care, Bowen said this about doctors. The more anxious the physician, the more likely he is to do too much speech making and too little listening. This is what I have to say. The more anxious the pastor, the more likely he or she is to do too much speech making and too little listening. Speech making is a way to keep our distance. We're talking at, we're not really open to the other person. So is small talk. But we can jump right ahead to resurrection, or we can immediately bolt to reading scriptures and engaging in rituals. And it's not just Catholics and Episcopalians who have rituals. Baptists do too. Let's all hold hands. We bring the patterns of cutoff we have in our own lives to our pastoral relationships. And that may block us from having significant pastoral relationships with people who are dying, because they're thinking about some important things. You try to tell yourself people don't want to talk about dying, but I promise you, if they know, you will listen. They'll talk. In fact, this was something that was a real learning moment. Back when I was starting doing work with AIDS, a therapist who had worked with a lot of HIV patients was asked while doing a workshop, is there ever an appropriate time for the therapist to raise the question of dying with the client? And his answer was, it is my experience that the client raises the issue of death when he thinks the therapist is ready for it. I think it is my experience that the church member raises the issue of death when he or she thinks the pastor is ready for it. So it's important. It's important for us to be open. I don't know how people know what we're comfortable with. I just know they know. They know. I think we send off signals in some fashion. Well, okay, what might a dying person talk about? One of them is this, I find. Now, these are my observations. You may have some others, and I'll be really interested to hear them. But what I would term gathering up. What was my life? My favorite one memory of that is a woman in the hospital who was dying. I was a chaplain, and she had this great big, well-worn album of pictures, and it was all her family. And she said, this is mine. And we went through them, all of them. This was her life, and it was my opportunity to bless her life. Paying the rent. People want to know, it is my experience, that they have made up for the space they took up and the air that they breathed. What was worth it about my life? And maybe, well, we'll get to that in a minute. But sometimes people don't have a lot of good things they've done in their lives. Now, we like to think they have, but sometimes they haven't. And they need someone who in a spirit of grace will listen and hear about that. Reconciliation may not happen perfectly at all, but people sometimes have things they did that they are not proud of, that are wrong, that they need to strategize about how to make right what I have done. And in my experience, it is not helpful when someone is burdened with guilt to say, "That's okay. It was okay that you left your family and da 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 da. It was fine." They know better. And maybe they can only reconcile themselves to God. Maybe reconciliation with the person is impossible. Maybe it is. And those are hard steps that people sometimes. And finally, my legacy. What will live after me? Will my family be okay without me? I think that each of these has something to do with differentiation itself. I think it's an opportunity at the end of life to consider how I have lived. Consider the things I'm taking responsibility for in my life. Considering how to take responsibility to, if you will, finish well in my life. And it's important that they have someone who listens for that. And I think it's also important, I believe it is an effort at differentiation on the part of the pastor to be present, really present and open with someone, and remember that it's their life and they're dying. That is very important. Not to be the one who jumps in to try to fix it. Okay. Thinking a little bit about families. Sometimes I have been in hospitals where somebody is in a hospital bed and somebody is out in the hall sitting in a chair trying to get up courage to go in and see someone they haven't talked to in a long time. Now, I want to have a good and open relationship with the person I'm passing through. And if I can, that may help them some in time. But if I can manage to have an open, not so anxious relationship with both of these people, there's a chance that they may be able. Maybe not terrific, but better. And I believe the person dies better if I can do that versus having the relationship myself. Okay. I want to switch gears a little bit. Ended up with a 30-minute question and answer session that was just an extra gift, so I'm going to adjust it here. But we will be out of here by noon, and actually you may have a lot of feedback for this. But I'm going to switch gears now and talk a little more about funerals and ministry at the time of death. My goal is to use the phrase bury the dead at the time of death, meaning going away from that death with as little unresolved as we have. We'll often have some things that are unresolved, but how can we help the family bury the dead at a time of death? Now, help is kind of a word you gotta be careful about. Because a lot of times we think of help as you've got two buckets of water, I'll take one. And I'll carry that bucket of water for you. And the work that a family does, the going forward, the reconfiguring that a family does is work they do. I can't do it for them. However, we can give a family a better opportunity to bury the dead at the time of death, I think. Another quote. The funeral serves a common function of bringing survivors into intimate contact with the dead and with important friends, and it helps survivors and friends to terminate their relationship with the dead and to move forward. One of the hardest, I'm going to talk this afternoon about worst case scenario deaths, but one of the hardest deaths I ever worked with was a family, and it was worst case scenario in every way. This was a second grade child who drowned at a youth outing at the home of some church members. It was bad. And I remember going to the hospital and coming into the shock room where the little boy is dead and he's got the apparatus for resuscitation efforts in his mouth. The family, the parents are standing on either side, and I came over to stand with them. And they were with each other and with the body of their little boy. And one of the hardest things I've ever done in my pastoral life was not to get my arms around, but to let them have that moment to do this. And I will tell you, I had two church members who had come in and were watching and probably thought I was being a really cold fish. But I did it because it's important to let that occur. That doesn't mean never put your arms around anyone, but boy, we can sometimes short circuit what it is they're doing and need to do. I have not too long ago attended the funeral of one of my college roommates. And the family had a kind of interesting combination of fundamentalism and New Age in terms of how they approach things. But we got to the reception after the funeral. The funeral had been done without the ashes present. And her sisters were talking about how she's right here with us. And I said, well, yes, I mean, you know, there's many ways that I feel her memory. And they said, oh, no, you mean she's right here? Then, a few minutes later, her daughter walked in, forlorn, absolutely forlorn, and she had picked up the ashes at the funeral home. She walked in with her mother's ashes. That's another way of contact with the dead, of being real about what is going on. We want so badly to make people feel better. And there's some things that just aren't going to feel good no matter what we do. So, the best function of a funeral is served when it brings relatives and friends into the best possible functional contact with the harsh fact of life and with each other at this time of high emotionality. That's the best. There are things that militate against this. Sometimes we can help families think a little bit better about what to do. But memorial service with a private cremation, it's hard sometimes at some services to imagine someone has died. No. We're celebrating life. Well, yeah, but someone has died. Exclusion of children, parenthesis. There are occasional times I think it's really okay to exclude children when the significant adults in their life, for one reason or another, are really totally out of control. I have occasionally had a funeral that I was glad the children didn't see. But for the most part, my husband's family does this extremely well. From the time they can toddle or be carried in arms, children go to funerals. And so they know that's part of it. Pre-need planning, which sometimes includes saying, by darn, you're not having a funeral for me. You can get around that one, too. Sometimes families say, well, he didn't need it, but I did, okay? My husband's uncle died a couple of years ago. And as he was dying, my husband, who has been living with me for a while, talked to his cousins and said, you know, I hope at some point you will consider having a gathering where we can remember Glenn. Well, so a few months pass, and they call up and say, we think we're going to have a gathering. Well, then they call me, and they say, I'm wondering if you would help us with it. Sure. This is beginning to sound like a funeral. Then they sent an order and said, we're thinking of something like this. And I looked at it and thought some of it was pretty good. And then I sent back another order, basically the order for a funeral out of the Methodist Book of Worship. And they sent it back and said, that looks perfect. And so that's what we did. We gathered in their living room with the ashes present, and I put on a stole, and we had a funeral. Convenience is a nasty word where death is concerned. Death is inconvenient. Death is absolutely inconvenient. And trying to make it, you know, it would be more convenient to have a service at the funeral home. It would be more convenient to have, to bury them first, then have a funeral, then have lunch. That way lunch doesn't get cold. How convenient. Marie Mullen says this, I believe funerals were probably more effective when people died at home with the family present and the family and friends made the coffin and did the burial themselves. I have here a cover from Christian Century a bit back, and this is a picture of an old-fashioned funeral. The body is present. There are people around. Here's a kid. Somebody's crying. No? They're wondering what's going on, perhaps. But they got the idea that somebody died, right? At one of my friend's first church, when there was a death in the congregation, the members of the church kept vigil the entire night. Somebody was in with the body in the church all night long. And that dated back from the time there were not good embalming methods, and people put wet cloths on bodies to keep them from the funeral the next day. Laura. Be present at the time of death. Now, if they don't call you, you're obviously not going to be present. And maybe they're doing fine without you. But if they call and you say, do you want me to be alone? Oh, well, no, don't bother. Fine, won't they? There's every difference in the world between saying, do you want me to come over, and would it be all right if I came over? It's different. Set aside adequate time to plan with the family. I can, at this point in my career, plan a family or plan a funeral in 10 minutes. I mean, I can do it, okay? I never have, but I could. But how do you plan with the family? And in that whole process, planning a funeral can be part of that going forward process as the family works with each other, as they recall the person who has died, as they maybe discover they have some different memories of the person who died. It's a really important opportunity for them to be together and do that. One of the best funerals I ever did was a woman who had died at 102. She had one son, she had four children, eight grandchildren, and some great grandchildren. Four grandchildren, eight great grandchildren. Okay, trust me, generation of one. And one of the granddaughters, who was not young at the time, came into my office to see if I would do the funeral. And I said, as I usually do, are there people from the family who might like to speak? And she says, well, I know I'd like to, and I'll bet my father would like to. And anyway, by the time all of this happened, the father got up and spoke, and that's all we had there. It was me and the survivors, because she moved down from another place, and so she hadn't been young enough to make good connections. So first, father, her son spoke, then the daughter that I had spoken to, who was the eldest, spoke, and then without prompting, the other three spoke in verse 4, with the youngest one saying, I knew her very differently than you did, because she was so much older when I came along. And this next generation was soaking in all of that and really meeting somebody they hadn't known. It was absolutely a wonderful feeling. So this involves interest in the person and the family versus the task. How is it that this activity helps them go forward? And I do offer always opportunities for the family to participate. As a matter of principle on my part, I don't do eulogies. Because if I know the person, I will say something about how I knew the person. But who really is better to do the eulogy than the family? What I do is I say, okay, what I'd like you to do is write down some recollections here. Sometimes one person takes it on and polls the other people in the family, and it's really quite an event when they're putting all that together, you know? And I always say, please write it down. That prevents, going all over. And if you can't read it, I will. So they know they don't have to do that. But that is present in the funeral. Now, I think other people might approach that in some slightly different ways. But I find families normally respond really well to that. And normally, when they have done the task of pulling this together, that they very rarely will not speak it themselves. Take responsibility for religious leadership. What was the person's favorite scriptures? Well, maybe they know, and if they do, I always ask. But they're not the trained religious people. And so one of the things I can do is listen very carefully as they talk about the person and their life together and so on. And I can say, you know, the scripture that makes me think of is this one. Oh, yeah, that sounds perfect. And if it doesn't quite occur to me, I can go home and think about it and call them back and say, hey, I was thinking about this. And involve others. People in the congregation. Remember, we talked back here. Let's see. With each other, okay? When it brings relatives and friends into the best possible functional contact with the heart attack of death and with each other at this time of high emotionality. When someone bakes the casserole and takes it to the door, they have contact with the family. When church members usher, they have something that they do. When they call in the home, when they mow the lawn, when they bake cookies. That's part of that surrounding family. And I personally think that is worth organizing for ahead of time. In the large congregation where I was, I started a ministry called the Bethany Ministry, related to where Lazarus lived, for people. And people would call and say after death, what can I do? And I'd say, can you come to Bethany for us? Well, do Bethany meant work on the parking lot if it was a large funeral, or serve the dinner afterwards. Actually, we had a ministry that mostly did that. But be with the family, escort the family, be sure the family has a place to go and sit. We had one mammoth funeral where by the time I arrived, the Bethany team had already discovered that the room where the family usually gathered was way too small, and they had taken it upon themselves and moved them, got them set in, helped them enter the church because some of them had difficulty walking. And then after the funeral, which was a tragic out-of-season death, afterward, I watched, and as the family greeted this enormous congregation that tragic deaths bring out, there was someone there passing Kleenex to them. Well, that is the end of what I have to say.